Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are really cracking open the actual playbook for crisis management, specifically how emergency medical services, you know, EMS, shifts gears from the everyday stuff to full-on disaster response. And it's kind of a paradox, isn't it? Responding to disasters is like a core job for EMS. But the events themselves, they're defined by the fact that they always swamp the local resources, just overwhelm everything. They push a system built for, you know, a car crash here, a heart attack there, way past its limits.
That's exactly it. That's the tension we're looking at today. Our mission really is to pull out the blueprint, the actual structure that stops the whole system from collapsing when things get chaotic. We're digging into the phases, the nitty-gritty planning details, and some pretty surprising procedures needed for, you know, effective disaster management. Our source material, it lays out the whole life cycle. Everything from prep strategies, the whole philosophy of how you get ready, to dealing with, say, a hurricane versus a chemical spill, and just as important, how you pick up the pieces afterwards.
Okay, right. So let's unpack that, the core framework. When you read the playbook, disaster management isn't just like one big emergency call. It's a cycle, right? A continuous thing with five key parts. Can you walk us through those basics?
Absolutely. Yeah, think of it like a loop that never stops. Preparedness first, then planning, training, the actual response, and finally the after-action review. You really can't skip any step. Mess up the training now and, well, the response suffers later. And the absolute bedrock of good preparation. That's the all-hazards approach.
The all-hazards approach. Okay, that sounds like textbook language. What's it mean, practically speaking, for an EMS crew or agency?
It means you don't just prep for the hurricane you think might hit. You plan for everything that could possibly happen where you are. So, yeah, if you're coastal, hurricanes are obvious, but what if there's also a big chemical plant nearby? You need a plan for a hazmat incident too. Same time. The plan has to be tailored, you know? Specific geography, local risks, population. And here's a detail people often miss. How the number of people shifts. Big time. Think daytime commuters versus everyone at home at night. That completely changes where your ambulances and crews need to be staged.
That customization bit feels really key. It's not just a generic checklist. And the details in the before the event planning, I mean, it gets fascinatingly granular. It's way beyond just stocking more bandages. It's like sociology meets logistics.
Exactly. You've got to factor in demographics, things like language barriers or cultural stuff that might affect how people respond to evacuation orders. You need tailored communication. Then you get into resource management. Who do you need? Specialized staff. What supplies? Special transport, maybe? Like high-axle trucks for floods, and securing those critical agreements beforehand.
Like mutual aid, you mean?
Precisely. Formal mutual aid agreements. Who sends help when your own ambulances are all tied up? And pre-positioning supplies. You know, disaster caches. If you wait until the hurricane makes landfall to call the next county for ambulances, you're way too late.
Yeah. That makes sense. And the interagency part seems huge, too. It's not just EMS operating in a bubble. The sources really stress practicing together, right? Unified command drills, bringing in fire, police, even NGOs like CERT or the Medical Reserve Corps.
Oh, absolutely. If they haven't practiced together, the middle of a catastrophe is not the time for introductions. If the response isn't unified, it fragments.
Yeah.
Falls apart. You also need solid plans for infrastructure and comms. What happens when cell towers go down? Got backups. You need a designated public information officer, a PIO, to handle all the media, keep the message consistent, and really critical, clear rules for escalating the incident. Knowing exactly when a local commander needs to call for state or federal help, the training builds up, you know, individual skills, then crew, then the whole agency, and finally working with everyone else. That last step, that's the toughest.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. Phase two, during the event. Could be warning, could be sudden. But the sources say, stick to the plan, rigorously. But how do you actually maintain that structure when, you know, chaos is breaking loose and panic might be setting in?
You do it through accountability. And that command structure we talked about, every single person, every piece of gear, it gets tracked. Personnel check-in, for example, uses something like an ICS 211 form. That's the official roster. It tells you who's on scene, where they are, what they're assigned to do right now.
And the big operational idea during the disaster is that unification of command. Why is that specific term so vital?
Because imagine the mess if different agencies start giving conflicting orders. Gridlock, confusion, people get hurt, responders included. Unification means one lead agency directs things. Even if, say, normally EMS reports to fire, maybe in a mass casualty event, EMS takes the lead to the medical side while police handle security. But that only works if the trust is already there. from those drills.
And amidst all that, triage sorting patients has to be constant, ongoing. How is disaster triage different from what paramedics do every day?
Well, disaster triage, especially in a huge incident, often flips the priority. Instead of pouring everything into the single most critical patient, like you might normally do, you focus on saving the most lives possible with the limited resources you have. So the criteria might change based on the disaster, too. A building collapse. Some injuries might immediately be tagged expectant, meaning tragically resources aren't used because survival chances are near zero. That frees up resources to save maybe three others who can be saved.
And the paperwork. It becomes absolutely critical, not just for care, but for legal stuff down the road, right? Accountability.
Essential, yeah. Documentation in a disaster protects literally everyone involved. Every patient needs a record. Name, triage category, who transported them, where they went, that patient care report, the PCR. It ensures care continues smoothly at the hospital, sure.
Yeah.
But it also sets liability limits. If a responder gets sick later, maybe from exposure, or a patient alleges negligence, that paper trail is crucial.
But the operations are only as strong as the people running them. If this thing drags on for days, we have to talk about responder welfare.
Non-negotiable. Absolutely. For anything long-term, responders need regular access to basics. Food, water, restrooms, somewhere safe to sleep. Dehydration, exhaustion, they lead to mistakes, dangerous mistakes. But beyond just the physical side, the sources put a huge emphasis on mental well-being.
How does that mental support actually look during that kind of sustained stress?
It starts simple, like having a buddy system, people watching each other's backs. Mandated downtime is key. You have to make people rest. Agencies need to set up structured ways for people to talk about what they're seeing, what they're experiencing, not just casual chats. And maybe the most important piece, a formal peer support program. Access to CSSM, this critical incident stress management teams. CSSM is about tackling that potential trauma head on right away, trying to prevent acute stress from becoming a long-term injury.
Wow. Okay. And while all of that is going on, you're still managing a situation that's constantly changing.
Constantly. Yeah. Situational awareness has to be continuous. That means keeping an eye on the environment is the weather changing. That impacts deployment, safety gear, but also surveillance. Responders need training to spot and report anything weird. Suspicious people, unattended bags. You have to assume the initial event might not be the end of it. Secondary attacks are a real possibility in some scenarios.
So, okay, the immediate crisis passes. What happens then? We hit phase three, right, after the event. Recovery and review. This feels like the part that often gets overlooked, but it's where the real learning, the long-term work happens.
It really is. And accountability is immediate and strict. You need those duty rosters checked off, a PCR or a triage tag accounted for every single person, worker, or patient. Logistically, every bit of kit used needs checking, restocking, maybe replacing. Vehicles need servicing. Equipment needs checking for damage, weather, dust, chemical contamination, you name it.
And then the review cycle kicks in. How does that turn what just happened into better procedures for next time?
It starts with the people again. Addressing stress reactions before they become chronic. That's where CSMR follows up. Then the formal process. The after-action report. The AAR. That's the official internal document. It details what happened, what worked, what didn't, meticulously. It's the key tool for retraining, for proving competence to oversight bodies and the really good agencies. They actively solicit input. They hold, like brainstorm sessions, get honest, unfiltered feedback from the crews on the ground about the plan itself.
I noticed some seemingly admin details in the long-term recovery part that actually sound critical, like finances.
Oh, finances are huge. Getting a formal declaration of disaster from the government. That's what unlocks federal relief money. Reimbursement for all the costs, which are usually massive. And the human element again. Mandatory physical exams for anyone potentially exposed to hazards, and simple but vital, acknowledging good work, praise, recognition. It has to be frequent, immediate, and genuine to rebuild morale after something tough.
There's also the specific thing called reentry. That's not just unlocking the evacuation zone, is it?
No. It's a carefully managed operation, phased. The incident commander plans exactly how evacuated residents come back, checking credentials, making sure only people who belong there get in. And they have to work closely with the health department. Do we need specific vaccinations now? Maybe because of contaminated water or disease vectors stirred up by the disaster?
Okay, this brings us to how the planning connects to the type of disaster, because it changes a lot, right? Natural versus human-made or technical. Let's look at some of those specific requirements, maybe starting with natural disasters. Some surprising details there.
Definitely. Take hurricanes, the key insight from our sources. Always plan for at least one category higher than predicted. If they forecast a Cat 3, you plan your resources and responses if it's going to be a Cat 4. Always prep for the worst plausible case. Earthquakes. Biggest immediate threat is buildings collapsing, obviously. But responders absolutely must wear heavy-duty face masks. That air gets thick with concrete dust, drywall dust. It's a huge suffocation hazard and causes long-term lung damage.
And flooding. What's the key beyond needing boats?
High-axle vehicles are essential. Even seemingly shallow water can stall a standard ambulance. And responders need constant awareness of what's in the water. Hidden debris, industrial chemicals washed out, raw sewage. Plus, the risk of levees or riverbanks suddenly giving way, even if they look stable before.
And droughts. They cause that weird mix of problems you wouldn't immediately group together. Heat stroke, dust storms, wildfires, reduced water quality. And that one detail that jumped out at me, snake migration injuries.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of that granular localized planning. Drought forces snakes out of their usual dry spots looking for water, often closer to where people live. So suddenly, you need specific anti-venom caches ready and plans for rapid transport for snake bite victims. It's a real specific threat. Volcanoes, you're looking at burns, obviously, respiratory problems from the ash, crush injuries from collapses, and that ash fall is critical masks for everyone downwind immediately. That volcanic glass shreds lung tissue.
Okay, shifting gears to human-made or technical disasters. Here, the safety protocols seem to get even tighter and the legal aspects feel sharper.
They do. For cave-ins, like a trench collapse, you have to assume the patient was in an oxygen-poor, toxic environment.
Mm-hmm.
Sewer gas, natural gas, chemical fumes from ruptured lines. Responders need specialized rescue training, often outside normal EMS scope. Things like sloping, benching, shoring walls, just to reach the patient safely.
And power failures, IT disruptions. That secondary chaos we don't always think about.
Hugely disruptive, yeah. Do your facilities have manual overrides for electric door locks?
Yeah.
Gates. You absolutely must track patients relying on electric medical devices. Oxygen concentrators at home, ventilators. They need backup power or relocation fast and assume your tech will fail. Cell phones, GPS, downloading those electronic patient reports. Probably not working. Need paper backups ready to go.
Instantly.
Dealing with riots or civil disturbances, security becomes paramount there. Absolute top priority. Police escort is basically mandatory. Responders should probably be wearing body armor, maybe a helmet. Definitely an air purifying respirator for tear gas or other irritants. But here's the critical ethical and legal tightrope. EMS cannot, must not, take sides. Refusing care to someone injured because you disagree with their protest, that's abandonment. Gross negligence. Patient's medical need comes first.
Yeah, always.
And finally, explosions. How's that response different from just a major trauma scene?
You have to assume the worst. Secondary devices. Maybe tertiary. Entry is delayed until bomb squads clear the area. Ear injuries, blast barotrauma are super common, often missed initially. And the air is instantly contaminated with blast residue chemicals. So again, air purifying respirators are needed during patient care right there in the hot zone. You're juggling structural instability, contamination, hidden explosive threats all at once. Wow. What the sources really lay out is just the sheer complexity, the foresight needed. It covers everything from, like you said, snake migration to navigating the ethics of a riot. Effective response really does hinge on nailing those preparation details, covering this whole insane spectrum of potential chaos.
It really drives home that EMS isn't just reacting to calls. It's an integrated infrastructure, pre-planned, designed, hopefully, to keep functioning when everything else breaks down.
Yeah, it makes you realize, okay, the response starts with all the structured training, individual, crew, agency, interagency. But maybe the toughest part isn't that first chaotic moment. Maybe it's the sustained human effort needed to manage that chaos for days, maybe weeks.
I think that's right. Which brings up a really important question, something for you, the listener, to think about. When you face something truly catastrophic, an event that wipes out landmarks, knocks out communications, breaks supply chains, how absolutely vital is it then to see prioritizing the human element, the mental, the physical well-being of the responders themselves as maybe the ultimate form of disaster preparedness? Because if people break down, the best plan in the world is just paper. We'll leave you with that thought to mull over.